How many of you watched TV, looked at the internet, read a newspaper, or talked to somebody about what's going on in the world this week? Raise your hands. Okay, now keep your hands up. How many of you did not see anything about Lance Armstrong? One? Wow. Okay, good. You did, yeah. It's kind of a tricky way to phrase the question. Lance Armstrong is all over the news this week. After winning all these bike races and then being accused and finally found guilty, and then this week, Oprah confessing to using illegal drugs, he's fallen. And our culture is obsessed with it. I think I've seen more about Lance Armstrong this week than I saw about the presidential race during the week that we were electing a president of the country. It's made me ask, why are we so interested in this? What is it about this story that is so fascinating? And I think it's because there's something about when a hero disappoints us that really stirs something within us. Has that ever happened to you? Have you had somebody in your life that you've looked up to? Somebody that you've aspired to be like, that you've seen as a role model, and then they did something that you couldn't believe? And they fell. They disappointed you. That's what we're going to be talking about this morning. We're going to be looking at God's people in God's city with God's temple destroyed. The unthinkable is going to happen. The hero will be judged. Last week we began the story of two sons, the good son and the bad son. I suggested that the northern kingdom of Israel was the bad son. They had walked away from God. They had rebelled. All of their kings were listed as evil. And so last week we saw the bad son judged. But we also saw King Hezekiah, and I suggested that the southern kingdom of Judah were the original nation of God's people. They were the good son. Hezekiah was a good king. They had the line of David. They had the temple. They were the favored ones. But this morning, we're going to be disappointed by the good son. This morning, we're going to see even the faithful kingdom of Judah, even Jerusalem, judged. We'll find out that the good son isn't as good as we thought he was. As most of you know, we're in this church-wide effort we're calling EPIC, the Astonishing Story of God and the World. We've arranged these 10 eras that are represented by our light boxes to guide us through the story, to give us markers, to know where we are in the course of the story. This week, we're in the era that we've called A Nation Banished. And over these several weeks, we've been seeing the people of God in decline. We've been seeing the nation falling apart. Last week, we saw the northern kingdom judged. And this week, we will see Jerusalem fall. This week, Jerusalem will be taken. And if you're following the story, this comes as a surprise in the course of the story. What happened last week made sense. We thought the northern kingdom should be judged. They were rebellious. But we can't understand why God would let the kingdom of Judah, Jerusalem, his temple, be destroyed. This morning, the hero will fall. And when a hero disappoints us, we have two choices before us. We can either give up on heroes altogether, or we can look for a hero that doesn't disappoint. In the wake of the news around Lance Armstrong, surely a lot of people will say, forget it, nobody can be trusted. Others will look for someone else to look up to. And when Jerusalem fell, some people gave up on God and said, forget it, I can't believe in a God like this. But others looked for a God that can be trusted, for a new kind of hero, for someone that wouldn't disappoint. That's what we're going to see this morning. We're going to see as these events move forward how each of them point us to something other than what we used to hold out as a hero. We're going to see the kind of hero, the kind of king that we need by the ways that the failures have come about. We'll find out about a king that won't disappoint us. Well, our story last week ended with King Hezekiah in the southern kingdom. He was a good king. He was a great king. He was a young boy when he became king, but he did great stuff. He tore down the idolatrous altars. He rebuilt up the temple. He celebrated this huge Passover. He brought the nation back to God. But here's the problem with the great king. He dies. And when he dies, somebody else becomes king in his place. In the case of Hezekiah, it was his son, Manasseh. So let's find out what kind of king Manasseh was. We're going to start in 2 Kings 21. I'll read verses 1 to 6. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 55 years. His mother's name was Hephzibah. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, following the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. He rebuilt the high places his father Hezekiah had destroyed. He also erected altars to Baal and made an Asherah pole, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. He bowed down to all the starry hosts and worshiped them. He built altars in the temple of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, "In Jerusalem I will put my name." In both courts of the temple of the Lord, he built altars to all the starry hosts. He sacrificed his own son in the fire, practiced sorcery and divination, and consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the eyes of the Lord, provoking him to anger. So Hezekiah worked really hard to clean things up, to repair all the bad things his father had done, to tear down the altars, to restore worship of the one true God. But then he dies, his son becomes king, and Manasseh rebuilds everything. He rebuilds the altars to Baal, rebuilds the Asherah poles, even sacrifices his own son. If you follow his story in 2 Chronicles, he eventually repents, but by that time it was too late. The damage had been done, the nation had been led astray. I think a lot of us know this feeling, this cycle. I'm familiar with it in my kitchen. You know that feeling after a meal, you clean up, you do the dishes, you wipe down the tables, everything was a mess, and then after some hard work, you look around and the kitchen is clean. It's a great feeling. But then what happens? You get hungry again, and you have to eat again. And so you mess up the kitchen again. You can't keep the kitchen clean. It's impossible. And this is the problem that Manasseh shows us. His father may have been a great king, may have been one of the best kings, but great kings only last as long as great kings last. And eventually somebody else comes along, and who knows what kind of king that's going to be. Throughout the epic series, we've seen all of these solutions that God has demonstrated as possible solutions to the great problem of his creation that has strayed from him. In Noah, we saw God try and start over, but that didn't work. People still turned against God. With Moses, we saw God lead his people out of slavery, free them in a dramatic way, but that didn't work. They still turned against God. With Joshua, we saw God take his people into a land, provide the resources they needed, but they still turned against God. With Samuel, God gave his people a wise judge to lead them and intercede for them, and they still turned against him. So they gave him a king, and finally David became king, and he was a good king and a right king, but still they turned against God. It's as if God is showing us all of the ways to fix what's wrong that won't work. He's parading these possible solutions before God's people over the course of this story, almost as if he's trying to get us to the point where we realize how dire the situation is, and that there's really only one solution that is ultimately going to solve the problem of the world, and that solution is a drastic one. What we learn as we watch these kings in Jerusalem, good king, bad king, good king, bad king, is that one great king isn't enough. What God's people need isn't a great king, but an eternal king. The only way the kingdom's going to last, the only way you can really guarantee peace in the long term, is if you know that the king will be there forever. That's what God's people need. We need an eternal king. And this realization helps us to rethink what we spend our time on. Kings are mortal. They are temporary. They don't last. And when we see that, we're invited to look up, to look beyond that towards something eternal. And we are invited, as we consider our lives, to focus on what's eternal. Focus on the eternal. We spend a great deal of energy in our lives trying to become a great king, trying to fix our life, trying to do what's right, trying to build something here and now to make it the way we want it to be. Honestly, sometimes I worry that a lot of what we talk about in church, as Christians, as believers, is focused around fixing our lives, becoming great, having great homes, having great marriages, having great families, being great in our jobs, being a great church. And those are good things, but if that's all it is, it's going to pass. The only thing that's bigger than that is what's eternal, is God himself. And we need to realize that we need an eternal home. We need an eternal family. We need an eternal marriage. We need an eternal church. We need to be drawn away from some of these things that consume our lives toward God himself. As parents, this is real easy to fall into this trap. Our culture tells us that if you work hard enough, if you read the right books, if you say the right words, if you discipline the right way, then you can make sure your kids turn out well. That's a great promise, right? That sells a lot of books. Two problems with that, though. Number one, it's wrong. It doesn't work. And number two, as a parent, it drives you crazy. If it's all up to you, I mean, if it's all up to me, my kids are in trouble. But the truth is, my focus has to be on something bigger than how my kids turn out. My focus has to be drawn up. One of the things we think about as preachers, and you may not be able to tell this, but we try and think about being relevant, right? It's one of these words that we use. You want a sermon to be relevant to where people are at. And that's a good thing, and I certainly try for that. But if we make God fit into our lives, if our focus on being relevant is so much that we bring God into our experience, then we've done all of us a disservice. Because the truth is that as we come here on a Sunday morning, our goal is not to fit God into our lives, but for our lives to open up to receive God. Our focus is to be confronted with who God is, to see him, to engage with him, and ultimately to end in worshiping him. That's what we need. We need to see God, to focus on the eternal. So we need an eternal king, and we have an eternal king in Jesus. But it's not Manasseh. Manasseh is an evil king, and God says that he's going to judge Jerusalem because of Manasseh. Listen to Micah 3, verse 11, the prophet says this. In verse 12, "Therefore, because of you, Zion will be plowed like a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble, the temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets." Jerusalem is going to be judged. The bad king is too bad. It's gone on long enough. But before that happens, there's another king. There's a brief interlude before the judgment of Jerusalem. The next king is Manasseh's son. He only reigns 2 years, but Manasseh's grandson is a guy named Josiah. And Josiah is a remarkable king. Listen to how he's described in 2 Kings 22. Read the first two verses. Sorry, 2 Kings, 22. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 31 years. His mother's name was Jedidah, daughter of Adiah. She was from Bozkath. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and walked in all the ways of his father David, not turning aside to the right or the left. So after this terrible king of Manasseh, now we have another good king, Josiah. And Josiah was a great king. He discovered the book of the law after it had been left collecting dust for years. He rebuilt the temple. He reinstituted the Passover. He once again brought God back into the national life of Judah. In fact, he's described as the best king that the people of God ever had. Listen to this, 2 Kings 23, 24 and 25. Furthermore, Josiah got rid of the mediums and spiritists, the household gods, the idols, and all the other detestable things seen in Judah and Jerusalem. This he did to fulfill the requirements of the law written in the book that Hilkiah the priest had discovered in the temple of the Lord. Neither before nor after Josiah was there a king like him who turned to the Lord as he did with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his strength in accordance with all the law of Moses. Neither before nor after was there a king that turned to the Lord as he did. We read something similar last week in describing Hezekiah. He was described in glowing terms, but I think this description of Josiah is even stronger. He was the best. That surprised me. I always thought David was the best king, but here Josiah is as good as it gets. He's the guy. He's the real hero. He's a true role model. He is to be looked up to. But here's the thing. It still isn't enough. You might think that if Josiah was so good, wouldn't God stop this judgment that he had predicted? Well, our passage continues, 2 Kings 23, verse 26. Nevertheless, the Lord did not turn away from the heat of his fierce anger, which burned against Judah because of all that Manasseh had done to provoke him to anger. So the Lord said, I will remove Judah also from my presence as I removed Israel, and I will reject Jerusalem, the city I chose, and this temple about which I said, there shall my name be. And so, even Jerusalem is judged. Josiah was as good as it gets. He was the best king that a man could be, but it still wasn't enough. And when we realize that the best we have to offer, the best that a man can be, still isn't enough, it leaves us in a place where the only option before us is to receive mercy, to receive grace, forgiveness. If our best isn't good enough, then our only hope is mercy. And we are invited to receive God's mercy. If you're like me, you don't really like mercy, though. You like working hard, being in control, knowing you've done a good job, and getting rewarded for it, right? That's what we prefer. We prefer to be in control of our fate. We prefer for it to be on our shoulders as long as we're doing well, as long as our shoulders are strong. This mercy thing takes a while for us to get used to. Last week, I compared this story that we're looking at with the northern and southern kingdoms to the story that Jesus tells of the son who runs away. The younger son runs off and squanders the money, but he comes back asking for mercy. And at the end of the story, it's the good son, the older brother, who seems unwilling to be able to handle the mercy the father is willing to give. And that becomes the real point of the story. I don't know about you, but I think I resonate more with the older brother, with the good son. And I think there's a lot of good sons in this room. People that try hard, that take God seriously, that offer God our best, that diligently want to please God. The problem is, when we're trying our best, sometimes that can make it hard to receive mercy. Because we think, I'm working as hard as I can, I'm doing all that I can. God, don't I deserve something for that? Isn't my best enough? And yet Josiah shows us it's not. We're still dependent on God for his mercy. And thank God we have a God who is merciful. What about you? Are you working really hard? In the midst of that, can you receive mercy? Can you let God show you grace? Manasseh reminds us that we need an eternal king. The cycle of kings goes on and on. Josiah reminds us that we need a perfect king. We need a divine king. That's the only kind of king we need, and we can't be it. And now we get to the conclusion of this story. Now we see the unthinkable happen. Listen to how it's described in 2 Kings 25, 1 to 7. In the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army. He encamped outside the city and built siege works all around it. The city was kept under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. By the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine in the city had become so severe that there was no food for the people to eat. Then the city wall was broken through, and the whole army fled at night through the gate between the two walls near the king's garden, though the Babylonians were surrounding the city. They fled toward the Arabah, but the Babylonian army pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho. All his soldiers were separated from him and scattered, and he was captured. He was taken to the king of Babylon at Riblah, where sentence was pronounced on him. They killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. Then they put out his eyes, bound him with bronze shackles, and took him to Babylon. This was the end. This is the final invasion of Jerusalem. There have been several times in the previous years where the king of Babylon had come and Judah had always agreed to pay tribute and they'd been saved from destruction, but this time it was over. This time the city burned, the king was blinded, the temple was destroyed. Jerusalem had fallen. And I don't think that we can quite understand how shocking and horrific this was. Most of us have never lived in a country that was conquered by another country. That's an experience that's foreign to us. Seeing our favorite team lose is probably the closest that we get. And some of us get really upset about that. But this was God's city, his temple, the holy people, the chosen nation. This was the place where God chose to put his name, and it burned, overtaken by enemies. This is why Jeremiah says this in Lamentations, chapter 2, verse 15. All who pass your way clap their hands at you. They scoff and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that was called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? All your enemies open their mouths wide against you. They scoff and gnash their teeth and say, we have swallowed her up. This is the day we have waited for. We have lived to see it. The Lord has done what he planned. He has fulfilled his word, which he decreed long ago. He has overthrown you without pity. He has let the enemy gloat over you. He has exalted the horn of your foes. This is a dark day for God's people. the darkest. And it makes us ask God, why do such dark days happen? Why are so many terrible things allowed to happen? Now, there's an answer to that question. There are theological answers to why Jerusalem was conquered. There are answers that make sense in the course of the story. There are logical answers. There are answers that make sense in a classroom. But as you're being led away from the holy city in shackles with the smoke rising behind you, there aren't answers that work for you. As you're dealing with cancer or losing your job or attending your child's funeral, there aren't answers that work in those situations. There aren't answers that help us when we're going through the darkest times of hurt and pain. But I'm convinced that when we go through those times, we don't need answers. When we realize that our life isn't going to look like it's supposed to look like, when we realize that this pain might be with us for a long time, it's not answers we're most in need of, it's the God of the universe. God is not an answer to our question, he is a person who comforts us in our pain. And Jeremiah understands this better than anyone. That's why a few verses after what he says in Lamentations 2, he says this in Lamentations 3, starting in verse 20. I well remember them, that is, his afflictions, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore, I will wait for him. In the midst of this disaster, Jeremiah realizes that the only thing he has left is God himself. Everything else has been stripped away. And so he turns to God and says, I will wait for you. I will wait for your comfort. I will wait for your healing. I will wait because you are with me. And that's what we're left with as well. As we get to this point in the story and we see the destruction of Jerusalem and we realize the difficult things that happen in our own lives, the only thing open to us is to wait for God, to throw ourselves on him. We are invited to wait for God. There is another option, though, and that option is to give up, to throw in the towel, to say, it's just too hard. I'm not going to do it. But that doesn't really make things any better either. The only real choice is to wait for God. And in the midst of painful things I found in my life, those are the times I have the most intimate experiences with God. I wish it weren't so. I wish that when things were great, that's when I felt closest to God. But the truth is, it's the hardest times. It's in the midst of questions and pain and doubt when I experience God, when we have the opportunity to experience God in a remarkable way. And if the best thing is knowing God, then isn't that worth it? What good are good things if they keep us from the best thing? What good is being happy and secure and leading a nice life if we have walked away from our God? And so God lets Jerusalem fall. He lets the unthinkable happen. He lets the enemies of God gloat in their victory, and the faithful people of God are led into exile. This week in the news, we saw a hero fall. Lance Armstrong confessed to using illegal drugs. But to keep it all in perspective, this is just a guy riding a bike, right? What we've seen this morning is so much bigger. God's people, his nation, his city, overrun by the enemies of the Most High God. this cycle of good and bad kings shows us that we need something more than a great king. We need an eternal king. This incredible king of Josiah shows us that we need something more than an incredible king to pick up the pieces. We need a perfect king, a divine king. And when everything falls apart, we realize that the only thing we have left is to wait on God, to trust that he will be there. There's one more passage I want us to end with. It's right at the end of 2 Kings, and it's a curious way to end the book. Listen to 2 Kings 25, starting in verse 27. In the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, in the year Evil-Merodach became king of Babylon, he released Jehoiachin from prison on the 27th day of the 12th month. He spoke kindly to him, and he gave him a seat of honor higher than those of the other kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiachin put aside his prison clothes and for the rest of his life ate regularly at the king's table. Day by day, the king gave Jehoiachin a regular allowance as long as he lived. And we read these words and we say, great, this guy got to change his clothes and eat nice food. What does that have to do with anything? I think this little postscript from 30 years after the exile began gives us this glimmer of hope. It's as if the light has pierced the clouds and we just see a sliver, but it's enough to say, even though Jerusalem's fallen, even though his people are in exile, something good is coming. It's not the end of the story. There is something else. It's not grand yet. It's not what we'd hope. It's a change of clothes and some nice food, but it's something. All throughout this story, we've seen our eyes drawn upward to God, towards something eternal, towards something perfect. We've waited for God, but now at the end of the story, our eyes are drawn forward in hope to see that this God that we have seen, that we've experienced, now might act. And so we trust that waiting for him won't be in vain. We trust that God's mercies are new every morning and that the night won't last forever. Please pray with me. God, thank you that when we wait for you, you show up. And in the midst of dark times, we don't know how you'll show up, but we know you will be there. Pray that you help us to see you, to encounter you. And as we enter into worship through song, I pray that you would draw us toward you through the music and the words. God, help us to see you. In Jesus' name, amen.